Prescriptions for Health with Dr. Len and Vicky Saputo, Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, January 9th, 2012. I'm Dr. Len Saputo, and we're live.
And I'm registered nurse Vicky Saputo. It is good to be back live after the holidays, and we hope you're all happy and well. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are archived on DrSaputo.com and on PRN.fm.
And today you're going to hear Vicky's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include osteoporosis news. Is calcium deficiency really the cause of osteoporosis, or is there something else sneaking in there?
And we have a possible cancer breakthrough with a liver nutrient, of all things.
And another one from a fish oil derivative that cures leukemia. Wow.
And what ingredient in candy can prevent cavities and gum disease?
And the ethics of overtreatment in intensive care units, there's a good one.
And the medical use of insects.
There you go.
And much more.
So if you want to join us in our conversation and have questions about your health or our topics, give us a call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
Well, it looks like we have a breakthrough in osteoporosis because calcium deficiency may not be the cause. They did some studies in Spain. Actually, they were on deer antlers, and they did them this month in the Frontiers of Bioscience, and it showed that there was a lack of manganese, not calcium, that causes osteoporosis because manganese is necessary for calcium absorption, and it lets calcium bind to the bone like a glue. So what do you think of that one?
I think it's wild how we find things out. You know, it's by accident. It's by something called serendipity that we find so many things out. And how do we find out? By looking at deer antlers. And here's the story.
I didn't even know deer antlers were bone, I guess, because they lose them and they come back.
Yeah, and I didn't know there was snow in Spain.
So. You know, I bet we could find something in deer antlers to make bone grow faster.
Well, yeah,
manganese.
So what they did is they went ahead and noticed that deer were losing their antlers, and their antlers weren't very strong, and it had been a really cold winter that was unusual. And the plants that the deer eat in the wintertime when it's really cold don't take up manganese like they normally do. And so the deer all had a manganese deficiency, and they made that connection. And now here we are at a place where we're going, whoa, manganese may be the real problem that's causing osteoporosis, because a lot of people have normal calcium stores in their body, but not much in their bones. And if you have manganese present, what it does is it allows that calcium not only to be absorbed from the gut, but also to be sticky so that in bones, so that the calcium that comes along will be able to take up that calcium and keep you from getting osteoporosis.
Well, another thing that I thought was interesting is that manganese is also taken from the bone by more important organs.
It is.
Like the brain, for example.
It's like the storage depot for it, but also obviously has a role in bone itself. So it's kind of neat to know that the reserves that are there can be used for the brain and for the liver and the kidney and the pancreas if they need manganese to do the work they do.
So I thought it was also interesting that they found that lack of manganese can also set the stage then for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's.
Well, if you're manganese deficient, that's a real problem for people who have brain disease, because we have to look at what does manganese do. It's important to make connective tissue for bones, for blood clotting, to make sex hormones, and really important for the brain and for nerve function.
And I don't want people to mix this up with magnesium, because
right,
manganese is different.
Exactly.
Actually, the places that you get manganese, I think it's helpful for people to know how you can get it, it is from your vegetables, but also from legumes and nuts and seeds.
Yeah, it's also in tea, of all things, which is kind of odd. So if you're drinking a lot of tea, you'll get your manganese, but keep in mind you also get a lot of fluoride. So, you know, you don't want to do anything to excess. So this new breakthrough that is giving us more knowledge about what happens kind of tells a story that makes it more complete.
You know, they did this study, too, showing that 40% of people that had osteoporosis had cerebral dysfunction.
Yeah, it's interesting, and it makes kind of sense that that be the case, because if we need manganese for normal neuron function and for brain function, if we're short on it, why not? I think it would be something that would aggravate any of the diseases that are deficiency diseases in the brain, like Alzheimer's or senile dementia or Parkinson's.
Do you think it's a good idea, then, for people to ask their doctors to do a manganese level on them?
No, I think it's a good idea for them to eat a lot of seeds and nuts and legumes and drink a little tea. I'm the sort of person that really likes the idea of doing something that will help to take care of us through lifestyle. We rely too much on medicines, and I don't look at herbs and supplements any differently. We shouldn't have to do any herbs or supplements unless we live a lifestyle that's not good, or we happen to be really unfortunate and be in a place where we can't get the nutrients because they're not in the soil, or because, you know, usually we're just eating bad food. We're eating too much fast food. So this whole business of osteoporosis now is making a little bit more news, and I have noticed as I looked at some of my products that we use to treat people who have osteoporosis, they actually have a little bit of manganese in them. So somebody knew this before, and so this isn't something that's
everybody,
brand new thought.
I mean, I think that the scientists know that bones aren't just made out of calcium, or they'd just be looking like chalk.
Yeah, if it's calcium carbonate, that's what chalk is. But it's got magnesium and copper and boron and zinc and silica.
Phosphorus.
Yeah, it's got all kinds of things that are really mixed so that we get good. All right, the lines are open here on Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
More research is being done to find alternatives to chemotherapy for cancer besides herbs like artemisinin and methyl jasminate that we've talked about on other shows.
Mm-hmm. And the fish oil business as well, the derivative from fish oil, huh?
And now there's a new study showing that lithocholic acid, naturally produced in the liver, selectively kills cancer cells without harming the healthy cells. And it even prevents metastasis. Now, this sounds, is this too good to be true?
Probably. Because, see, what they're doing here is what they always do, is they're putting out news before all the research has been done. And in this particular case, what they're doing is they're doing tissue culture studies. These aren't studies done in human beings. In fact, they're not even done in mice yet. They're thinking about taking their tissue culture work and extending it now to do it in mice. And I think the idea of using lithocholic acid is a good one because it's something that the body makes itself. Actually, we only make two bile salts. We make one called chenodeoxycholic acid and another one called cholic acid. And when they get in the intestinal tract, the bacteria convert them into lithocholic acid and something called ursodeoxycholic acid.
Yeah, like everybody's going to remember that.
No, they're not. But it's just kind of to give them a picture of how the body works and how its biochemistry works and where lithocholic acid comes from. So when the bacteria turn the bile acids into lithocholic acid, it's reabsorbed, and then it goes to the body where it can be used as a bile salt as well.
Well, I think this is a good start. I mean, they show that it's working in brain and breast cancer so far.
It does some impressive things, and it was published in a journal called OncoTarget. So we're looking at something that is significant, and it's promising, and it might be something that you could consider using in somebody who has advanced cancer and there's no other treatment possible. It'd be one of those things you'd be mulling around going, do you think this would be worth a try?
Well, this is something we've been dreaming of, is something that can get the bad cells without harming the healthy cells. Mm-hmm. And also if it could prevent spread.
Well, see, that's what cancer therapy is all about anyway. Looking for products that can be patented. I don't think this one could, because it's a natural substance, so that would take away from some of the research. But the National Institutes of Health should really be thinking about doing this kind of research, because this is what, you know, they come from tax dollars, and we're trying to help the people. And whether or not there's a patent on it or not shouldn't be a concern of the National Institutes of Health or the people. We just want something that works. Now, when people are in stage cancer, very often the oncologists are thinking, well, we should at least try a clinical trial, or we should use another kind of cancer treatment that's conventional. And nearly always, these are really low-risk opportunities that are not the safest thing to do, that are probably going to cause side effects that are going to be major, because most chemotherapies are like that. And if these approaches were so good, they'd already be in the mainstream and everybody be using them, but now they're left as last resorts. But when you're looking at the kinds of things that Vicki and I are talking about, whether it be the methyljasminate, which is just an enzyme that kills mitochondria, or you're looking at lithocholic acid, which kills mitochondria, or you're looking at a fish oil derivative that may do something to help people with certain kinds of leukemia, I mean, those are much safer ways to go and more appealing to someone like me.
Yeah, well, I also think that we're going to have trouble with something like this just because of the pharmaceutical companies not being able to patent it. So in order to get the studies and in order to make money off of it and to sell it, it's going to be tough because it's a nutraceutical,
well,
basically.
Well, it's that way for all nutraceuticals.
Yeah, it's really too bad.
Well, it is, but the disappointing part is our National Institutes of Health. I mean, they've got something called a Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, but they don't fund it much, so you can't get much. I mean, there are billions of dollars, probably $30 billion that goes into all the different kinds of research that are done through NIH. There must be 20 or so different departments that are centers for mainstream therapies and only one for complementary and alternative.
Well, this is where I think some of the money should go for all these marches and walks for the cure.
Oh, exactly. I mean, organizations like the American Cancer Society, I would never support. I mean, personally, I couldn't imagine anybody supporting them with the track record they have and the conflicts of interest that we all know about now. I could never do that. But NIH is not really far above them. I think they are above them, but they're not far above them. Whenever you've got conflicts of interest, things happen that you wish wouldn't, because people are more interested in making sure that they get what they want. And a lot of it's about money. When you look at the total number of dollars spent on research in this country, it's close to $100 billion a year now. And about $60 billion comes from the pharmaceutical industry and only $30 billion from the National Institutes of Health. So it just shows you that the government is a smaller player. And so that's why we're seeing some of the things that we see, because when it comes to the quality of research that we're getting, you can't trust somebody who has a conflict of interest, because they do things that are going to try to make their results look better than they actually are. So they're always looking for ways to present it in a way that it looks better.
Well, the other thing that you touched on a little bit was about the fish oil for cancer, because this is actually a pretty new article that just came out. It came out in the December publication of a journal called Blood. Because fish oil, a fish oil compound in mice cured chronic myelogenous leukemia. And so this is a big deal. I mean, we know that fish oil is a healthy thing. I mean, there's a lot of things that fish oil is good for.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's a good anticoagulant. It's good for arrhythmias, for preventing heart attacks and strokes and inflammation and anxiety, and for our brain and our blood pressure, all kinds of things.
Exactly.
And even for prostate cancer, you know, which is another type of cancer. So this is really, I think, exciting news. But again, we have sort of the same situation as with the liver derivative, because it's not a pharmaceutical drug. It's a natural thing.
Well, yeah, but this was at least tried in mice, okay? So they had a clinical trial on mice, and they took a derivative from this. It's called D12PGJ3, so it's got a long name to it. But what it does is it kills chronic myelogenous leukemia stem cells, and that's a big deal. Because CML, which is a short for that term, is a very tough disease to treat. A lot of places are doing bone marrow transplant. In these particular cases, they injected mice for just 1 week. They had complete cures without any relapses. So this was big. And what they think it does is it activates something called the P53 gene, which is a tumor suppressor gene. So if it activates that and regulates DNA damage in a better way, and it kills the cells, okay, that are the stem cells that cause the disease, you've got some powerful treatment here. So this thing,
and especially,
that
gets, it's also supposed to be effective in the terminal stage.
It's wild that we have something this good, and maybe can be patented. I don't know, but I think that it's something that offers great promise, and it makes you wonder if just using larger doses of fish oil might be better. But, you know, like most things that are in nutritional medicine, you have to eat a truckload of something to get the active ingredient in concentrations that are adequate in the human body. So this is good news to see something like that. And I think a lot of these things could be used in combinations. I mean, what would happen if we used things like the derivative from fish oil with lithocholic acid, with methyl jasminate and artemisinin and IV vitamin C? None of those are going to hurt anybody. We need clinical trials desperately. So if we're interested in helping people, I mean, these are the kinds of things that we should be doing research on. They're cheap. They seem to work. They don't have much of a downside. And they give you hope.
And they're certainly a lot better than taking something that's so toxic,
oh,
like
right,
the chemotherapy.
Exactly.
When I say better, I mean better in that it's not going to make you sick.
Exactly.
It's not going to have all those horrible toxic
exactly.
side
it's
effects.
That's one of the things about mainstream medicine that just irks me, is that we have some of these things that need to be studied. And the mainstream doctors, the mainstream oncologists, don't really look to these things for any kind of treatment in their end-stage patients, or even in their early patients. And it's a shame, because what you want as a patient is a doctor that knows the mainstream therapies that are proven, and there are a few chemotherapies that absolutely work, but there are also some that that can work amazingly well that are not the mainstream therapies, and they should be considered.
Well, I think many mainstream doctors have kind of a mental block about other things because they like to practice medicine in the way that they're used to, that they're comfortable with, mm-hmm. and the unknown for them is a challenge, and they're kind of afraid of it.
Well, they think they're science-based. They have this illusion that what we do in Western medicine is science-based. But I've got to tell you, there is no way in the world that a lot of the work that we do in medicine is science-based for the most part. When this was studied by the Office of Technology Assessment back in 1979,
okay,
a long time ago, the idea of looking at how much of medicine that we practice is based on good, solid science, and they came up with a number that was not the 85% that most doctors would say. It was just the reverse. It was 15%. And then when they looked at the amount of science that's good, solid science, it's in the medical literature, in the major journals, the number that came out of that was just shocking. It wasn't 99% like we would think. Again, it was the reverse. It was 1%. And what proves that is you look at people like Dr. Marcia Angel, who was the chief editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and there for 20 years working with the NEJM. And she quits her job, writes a book, and says the stuff that's coming across her desk that's getting into the journals is trash. And Catherine DeAngelis of the Journal of the American Medical Association did not quit her job. She's still there, but she has the same reservations. And the same thing with the Journal of Clinical Investigation. A person named Ushma Neal said the same thing, and she quit her job saying, I can't stand the quality of stuff that's not in our journals.
Yes, but you see, most mainstream doctors don't want to acknowledge that or admit it.
Well, they're brainwashed to think that it is that way, and they're getting their information from who? The culprits. It's like letting
companies.
The fox, you know, take care of the chicken pen, a chicken coop. It's unbelievable at some of the things that are done, and we're like in a trance, in a coma, where we're not looking at the facts. And I can't claim to have been a whole lot better than a lot of other doctors, because I practiced for 20 or 25 years before I got the idea that maybe some of the stuff I was doing wasn't working so good. So here we are. So the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888. I forgot the number.
The number is 888-874-4888.
And we'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's 2020 tip.
Quite a month after Christmas, just a little early, but I have a little poem for you called The Month After Christmas. 'Twas the month after Christmas, and all through the house, nothing would fit me, not even a blouse. The cookies I'd nibbled, the eggnog I'd tasted, at the holiday parties had gone to my waist. When I got on the scales, there rose such a number, when I walked to the store, less a walk than a lumber. I'd remember the marvelous meals I'd prepared, the gravies and sauces and beef nicely rare, the wine and the rum balls, the bread and the cheese, and the way I'd never said, no thank you, please. As I dressed myself in my husband's old shirt and prepared once again to do battle with dirt, I said to myself, as I only can, you can't spend a winter disguised as a man. So away with the last of the sour cream dip, get rid of the fruitcake, every cracker and chip, every last bit of food that I like must be banished till all the additional ounces have vanished. I won't have a cookie, not even a lick. I want only to chew on a long celery stick. I won't have hot biscuits or cornbread or pie. I'll munch on a carrot and quietly cry. I'm hungry, I'm lonesome, and life is a bore. But isn't that what January's for? Unable to giggle, no longer a riot. Happy New Year to all, and to all a good diet.
Oh, that's great, Vicki. It doesn't really talk about the reality of how we look at food. The average American between Thanksgiving and Christmas gains 8 pounds. In January, we lose a lot of that. It's amazing.
The other day I went for a walk with a friend of mine, and we were meeting near one of the local clubs, you know, uh-huh. the exercise clubs. Uh-huh. And the parking lot was just crammed.
Yeah, sure. And in December,
like,
no one was
and
there.
And she says, well, I wonder what's going on. And
yeah,
I said,
right.
It's called New Year's resolution.
Yeah, that's right. So for the next month, people are going to lose some weight and then gradually go back to their original style of eating. It's amazing how that's that way. Every year, it's the same story. And the New Year's resolutions, we're determined to want to do, but you know, you need a certain amount of pleasure every day. It's sort of like, let's say you need a pound of pleasure every day, and you're going to get it from several different sources. If you don't get it enough, and you don't get a pound a day, you're going to find out a way that you can make up for it. And a lot of people choose food.
Well, you know, I lost about 10 pounds, and the way that
By the way, you look fantastic.
Well, thank you. But one of the ways that I did it was that I always ask myself if I'm why I'm eating. Mm. Is it because I'm hungry? Mm-hmm. Is it something to do? Is it to distract me? Is it because I'm in the kitchen?
Yeah.
You know, the reason why. And so also it goes for how much you eat, because if you eat more than if you're eating just because it tastes good.
Uh-huh. Well, that's recreation. That's that pleasure part.
That's
the pound
the thing.
Of emotion.
So what I've really been trying to focus on is how much I need just to satisfy that feeling of hunger.
Well, you're right, and you've got a good point. And for some people, that's a really good approach. In fact, it would be.
You have to be in the mindset to be able to do it in the first place. I mean, or I would have done it before.
Yes. You know? But let's look now at some of the causes for why people overeat. So you don't have a lot of those causes. That's why you've always been beautiful, and your weight is ideal, and it always has been.
But I've always fought it. I mean, I've always always watched it.
Well, other people have problems with post-traumatic stress. They've been abused physically, emotionally, or sexually as kids, and they wind up bulimic or binging, and they have eating disorders that cause lots of problems later in life. And they have a hard time taking away the one thing that they can control that gives them pleasure. And so for you to be on a diet or to be strict with yourself and say, am I eating just for recreation or am I eating because I'm hungry, is not a fair comparison for people like that. Not that it wouldn't be good for them to use that logic. Because
I think it's the first thing is to get in touch with that. You know, mm-hmm. it's the beginning. It's just to notice. Just start noticing.
I think that's right. So it's very interesting at how we look at weight and food and what it means. The triggers that come up for a lot of people who have had the abuses I mentioned just drive them crazy. If they don't do something to relieve the tension by eating too much, they wind up doing things like cutting themselves or beating themselves. I have one patient who uses a hammer on herself. Yeah, from time to time. And she is a phenomenal person who works hard, who's struggling with this issue of eating disorder because of all the abuses that she had in her life. And it's very slow progress to see the changes that occur. And a lot of the times the person who has the problem doesn't see it. And yet the person working with them can see the transitions, can see their awareness starting to become something that is new. And they're noticing things about themselves. They're starting to not do so much to punish themselves because they just feel so bad. They feel worthless, some of these people. And they're beautiful people who have great potential that over time are gonna do big things with their life to help other people. It's a ironic way to look at this, but a lot of these people who go through these eating disorders, like I mentioned, are preparing themselves to be able to learn to coach other people who have this problem. Who could be a better teacher than somebody that experienced this, who knows the desperation, who has suicidal tendencies, that will do abusive things to themselves like we're talking about? Who could be better qualified if they recover from the process to a point where they can go through life and find some joy? Nobody I know.
Well, there are also lots of groups for people that have eating disorders that can be helpful, support mm-hmm. groups. Well, some of the hospitals, I know Kaiser has
yeah,
one.
Yeah, well, it's really a good idea. And it's good that all the people that are in the group can talk with one another so that they can share their experiences and talk about their triumphs and can move forward in a way that makes their life have a little bit of joy in it. And you can get over it. And the person that I'm working with is doing wonderfully. She doesn't know it mm-hmm. so much, but she's starting to get the idea, and she's getting some self-respect, and she's starting to say no to people. And she's doing a little bit of coaching herself as well. So,
well, anyway, what I was talking about is mostly just for people that want to lose a few pounds, that it's a good idea, you know.
Yeah, for people who haven't been through that, that don't have metabolic problems, that are just 10 pounds overweight, you know, that's a whole different story. And for that, yeah, that's a good trick. I do that myself, and, you know, I'm probably 10 or 12 pounds overweight now myself. Because I haven't been exercising because of the hip surgery that I recently had. And, of course, at the time of the year was the worst, because if you can't exercise during the time of the year when everybody's gaining 8 pounds, then it becomes an issue. So I do what you say, and I ask myself, am I really hungry? And most of the time I'll say, I'm really not. I'm bored, and I'm looking for recreation. And maybe I'll eat a little bit less for my recreation because I work hard, you know, and long hours. And sometimes I just need a break. But I think thinking about it like you do would be so smart, because then you wouldn't have the problem of just using food, you know, indiscriminately.
Well, another thing I've noticed is sometimes if I crave something, mm-hmm. it's better to have just a little bite of it than it is to try to satisfy it some other way. Because when mm-hmm. you start trying to satisfy it some other way, you eat all these other things to satisfy it. And it's like you might as well have just had that one square of chocolate or whatever it is, or that one bite of whatever you're craving, than to be trying to satisfy it in some other way.
Well, I think you're right. The whole business of eating disorders is complicated. And it is hard for an individual to work out how to lose weight. And that's why we have an epidemic of obesity in this country. I mean, we have 66%, two-thirds of America is overweight, and an awful lot of people are obese. And it's the same thing with our kids. And so we have an epidemic of type 2 diabetes, and we have all these programs that are designed to entice you to buy their products that I certainly do not support, because I think that's not the way to go about it. But, you know, a few people are successful, and what you see on TV is those people that are successful at losing it, and so they highlight that and give you the illusion that all you have to do is buy their product, and that will be the deal. Well, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We'll be back taking your calls after a short station break. Listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888 if you have a question about your health, or if you want to chime in our conversation.
You know, Chinese medicine has been using licorice root extract for years for things like digestive problems and colds and asthma and liver disease. And now scientists report dried licorice root can actually kill bacteria responsible for tooth decay, gum disease, and oral infections. So let's talk about licorice root extract. And also, I think we should throw in DGL at the same time to talk about what the difference is.
Yeah, I think that's what most people think about when they think about licorice root. They don't go out and buy licorice root at a Chinese herb store. They're buying the DGL, which means the glycyrrhizin, which is in it, has been taken out. And the glycyrrhizin is taken out because it can cause high blood pressure in some people. And it's also can have some GI side effects. It can be a problem. And it works as a very powerful antibiotic. And sometimes we use it in people who have acute hepatitis by itself because it's such a powerful antiviral agent.
I don't think you're supposed to use plain licorice root either with things like diabetes or kidney disease or certain medications or birth control pills or laxatives and steroids.
I think it's
like
a general rule. That's good advice. If you're experienced with licorice root and experienced with these conditions, I think you can titrate. As a general rule with somebody who's not experienced or somebody who's just a patient,
or just do the
don't mix them up.
Or just do the deglycerinated.
Well, you could, but I'd still be careful. Mm-hmm. I think that that's something that's wise. But let's go back and talk about this business of preventing tooth decay and gum disease. There are two antimicrobial agents that are in licorice. One's called licorocidin, and the other is licor isoflavone A, that are active antibacterial ingredients that can prevent tooth decay and prevent the gum disease that occurs that so many people have that requires going to the periodontist to have fixed. So that's good news, but it does a lot of other things too. It helps to make thicker mucus, and that's why I like to use it in my patients who have intestinal problems.
Because then the acid doesn't burn them.
Well, that's right, because that mucus sticks to the wall of the intestinal tract from the mouth to the anus. So you're covering the whole GI tract here with thick mucus that's resistant to the acids that are produced by the stomach or by the alkaline products that are in the lower digestive part of the intestinal tract. It also increases the production of immunoglobulin A antibodies, which are the major antibodies that are in the intestinal tract that protect against infections, such as the H. pylori, which, by the way, licorice root is very effective at combating, which a lot of people don't know. It can...
Sounds better than to take an antibiotic.
Well, it would be a lot better. And, you know, the H. pylori isn't just all bad.
Yes,
we've talked about it before.
It
helps with people who have asthma. H. pylori DNA that's there, it works as anti-inflammatory material. And it also works in people who have acute colitis, or chronic colitis for that matter, just have inflammatory bowel disease or maybe even IBS. So I find it to be my friend as a doctor who uses some herbs in his practice. I think it's really effective against things like ulcers and canker sores and people who have GERD, you know, the esophagitis from narrowing or of an opening that's too wide of
people
the
get heartburn.
Stomach. Yeah, it helps some people who have cough or asthma or eczema. It's interesting.
Eczema is topical.
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't really realize that until I was researching this a little bit for the show to find out that that's the case too. So that's good. The licorice candy is an interesting part to look at.
Yeah,
here.
I wonder if that would help. Because, you know, when they say it kills the bacteria in the mouth, I was thinking about when I was a kid, my great aunt and uncle used to eat sins, you know, for their breath.
Uh-huh.
And maybe it kills the bacteria that causes halitosis.
Well, yeah, that could be. But the amount of licorice extract that's in candy is small. The bulk of it's sugar and then binders, which are either starch gum or gelatin.
Well, the other thing is that they use anise instead of licorice a lot of times.
Yeah. So the licorice root's your friend if you're using it wisely. And there are a lot of times that I think in my practice I find it to be something that's really safe. So that's something we should keep in mind. The lines are open here in Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we have a call from Maria from Staten Island. Hi, you there, Maria?
Yes, hi, Dr. Len.
How are you?
Pretty good. I hear you talking about H. pylori.
Indeed.
And I wanted to tell you that my husband was evaluated by his general doctor 2 months ago, and the doctor told him to do a sonogram, and the doctor thought that it might have been asthma-related, but recently, 2.5 months later, informed us that he thinks my husband has H. pylori because of the other symptoms, blood works or whatever came back that shows he's got H. pylori.
Well, H. pylori is not just a bad guy, and unless he's having severe problems with an ulcer, my inclination would be to leave it alone.
Put it in our search box on drsaputo.com.
You'll see all the articles that we have on H. pylori that will explain what I'm saying. But I think a lot of doctors are very misinformed about H. pylori, and they get the idea that if it's there, you need to kill it.
Right, he wants to give him a whole bunch of antibiotics.
Yeah, I wouldn't, because 50% of us have H. pylori. So are we going to all, 50% of us, half of the world, going to take antibiotics and all the other stuff that go with it? I don't think so. You have to keep in mind that the microbiology of the gut, the ecosystem of the gut, has got 1,000 different species of microbes, and there's more metabolic activity there than any organ system in the body. And it takes care of itself as long as we don't disturb it. So if there are small amounts of microbes there, they don't cause any problems. It's when we have large amounts of them, because the little bit of endotoxin or other things that they produce that bother us don't amount to much, and our bodies can handle that. But when it gets excessive, because there's overgrowth of those microbes like Shigella or Salmonella or H. pylori, then you have a problem. Does that make sense to you, Laura?
It does. And let me ask you, what would be his first, what should he be doing? Because I'm very worried about the antibiotics. I don't want him taking those things.
Well, why did the doctor just give him the antibiotics because he found that there's H. pylori in his system?
Yes, he said that he needs these two different antibiotics.
Well, but you have to have symptoms from it before.
Well, his symptoms are the shortness.
Before you even think about doing that,
he's got shortness of breath, severe pain behind his rib cage. He's exhausted. He suffers with bloating, where he's very uncomfortable in his stomach area. Mm-hmm. And it's been going on for. Now I'm wondering when they removed his gallbladder 2 years ago, if it was H. pylori that was over manifested inside of him.
Well, has he had an upper GI endoscopy?
No, he has not.
That's what I think should probably be done, or at least that should be considered, because if he's having symptoms that are related possibly to the digestive tract, he could have an ulcer there. And if he does, I wouldn't have as much of a problem with managing it with antibiotics, although that's not the way I would choose to do it.
I think you could entertain yourself well on our website looking up H. pylori and looking up
ulcers. I will.
Ulcers.
I'm going to look it up now.
Yeah, go to Dr. Saputo, D-O-C-T-O-R, Saputo, S-A-P-U-T-O.com. Thanks for calling,
Thank
Maria.
You again.
Have a great day. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's final 2020 tip.
Is the best medicine.
Indeed.
Ho, ho, ho.
Okay, Santa.
And I think it's good if we can also have a sense of humor and laugh at ourselves. And, here's what Mark Twain has to say. If you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed. If you do read the newspaper, you're misinformed.
Oh, dear.
Winston Churchill says, I contend that for a nation to try to tax itself into prosperity is like a man standing in a bucket and trying to lift himself up with a handle. And a government which robs Peter to pay Paul can always depend on the support of Paul.
Right.
That was George Bernard Shaw.
And that's what's happened.
Gordon Liddy says, a liberal is someone who feels a great debt to his fellow man, which debt he proposes to pay off with your money.
Right.
And here's another one. If you think health care is expensive now, wait until you see what it costs when it's free.
That's a funny way to look at it, but it's true.
In general, the art of government consists of taking as much money as possible from one party of the citizens to give to the other. That was said by Voltaire in 1764.
Wow.
The only difference between a taxman and a taxidermist is that the taxidermist leaves the skin.
That's great.
What this country needs are more unemployed politicians.
That's for sure. I think we should vote them all out. That's the only reason I'm going to vote at the next election, is I'm going down and I'm voting every incumbent out.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What this country... Oh, yeah. So a government big enough to give you everything you want is strong enough to take everything you have.
That's true.
That was Thomas Jefferson. Mm. We hang the petty thieves and appoint the great ones to public office.
That's amazing, but true, huh?
And Will Rogers said, the quickest way to double your money is to fold it and put it back into your pocket. There are three kinds of men. The ones that learn by reading, and I don't know what the rest are.
Okay. Those are great, Vicki. Thank you. There's a little humor in that, but it's really sad when you think of how we think about things like that. Anyway, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And I think we have a call from Eric in Jersey. Hi, Eric. You there?
Hey, Dr. Saputo. How are you? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. How you doing, man?
All right, thanks.
Okay, so
I wanted to ask about your protocol for recommended for H. pylori, and also mention that I found an amazing a commentary on the study itself that was done during the when the scientists found H. pylori back in Australia,
right,
in the 70s, I think. So if anybody's interested, they could read the whole story on that. I found it on this site called SiberianTigerNaturals.com/H. pylori.htm. And they have the whole, it's pretty amazing. It's pretty much like a profiteering scheme for the pharmaceutical companies, actually.
No question, it's that too. But the Australian that did this work, I mean, took the stuff himself. I mean, took the H. pylori himself. And did some interesting work with antibiotics that I can't remember the details of, but if they go to your site, they can read about it. And so there's something to the H. pylori, no question, but it's more, way more complex than we realize. When you've got H. pylori doing good things as well as bad things, depending on where it is and what your situation is, I think that the treatment would vary. If I had a patient who had a big gastric ulcer, okay, or an esophageal ulcer, and H. pylori was there, I might consider using aggressive therapy that would include a couple of antibiotics and other things, but I wouldn't use the proton pump inhibitors like they do, because they have way too many side effects, and you're going to be using it more than 8 weeks most of the time.
That's like Prilosec and
Nexium and Acifex. Yeah, I wouldn't use those drugs. I'd use the DGL we talked about, because I think that it works better, it's safer, it's not addicting, and it still kills the bug, too, to some extent, where the proton pump inhibitors don't kill the bug. But most of the time, I say somebody just has H. pylori as an incidental finding. Would I do anything in that setting? The answer is no. I wouldn't treat it at all, except say maybe what you should do is make sure that you're eating a healthy diet and you're living a healthy lifestyle. I would probably suggest that they take a probiotic, which I think probably everybody would benefit from in this country, because our intestinal microflora is not normal because of all the toxins we're exposed to, the drugs that we take, the antibiotics, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, the steroids. All of the things that we take as a rule that screw up our microflora. So the way to straighten it out is take a probiotic. And if somebody's just kind of like in the middle road and they having a few symptoms but not much, and there's a little H. pylori there, then I would go ahead and I'd add to the probiotic something called L-glutamine, which is an amino acid that's a major metabolic fuel of a lot of the intestinal tract. I would add to it something else that has lots of nutrients that the gut likes. So things like Ultra Clear Sustain or something like that, which is made by Metagenics. And I would probably add a little bit of quercetin, which is an anti-inflammatory bioflavonoid. That's a great way to go to reduce inflammation that's in the gut and help with food allergies and any other kind of inflammation that's there. those are the ways I would look at, and I might add some mastic gum, which is an herb that kills H. pylori as well, that's well tolerated and safe. Those are the nutritional ways to approach it, that the orthomolecular ways to approach it that I think are really wise. So it would depend on the situation. So I wouldn't give a across the board answer that says I would never use an antibiotic, because there are times when I do, but they're not very common. They're not very common at all. Does that help you, Eric?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you consider using, because you didn't mention that, Siberian pine, nut oil and the sea buckthorn oil that has specific studies that have been done in the USSR that show that it heals peptic ulcers and all these kinds of things. It's pretty amazing.
You know, you may well be right. I don't know those particular products. I don't know the Russian literature that well. If you want to email them to me at Dr. Len, D-R-L-E-N, at drsaputo.com, I'd be happy to take a look at them, and I'll email you back and tell you what I think of it. I think there are a lot of treatments out there that work quite well that we just don't know about because we don't collaborate near enough with people who do different kinds of medical treatment. So that's how I do it. So
sure, I'll
appreciate
definitely
the call.
Email you. I'll definitely email you the stuff. And in the meantime, you could take a look at that site as well, the one I mentioned, the SiberianTigerNaturals.com/hpylori.htm.
Eric, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
A great day. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Here's a topic that might surprise you a little bit when you first hear about it, but as we get into it, you'll understand it, that most ICU doctors and nurses think that there's enough excess care in the intensive care unit that they're not happy with their jobs. So you might ask, well, what does that mean?
Yeah, really.
Well, there are a lot of people that are end up in the intensive care unit that get more treatment than probably what they need. Like, for example, if somebody is elderly and they're full of cancer,
right,
and they end up in there with tubes out of every orifice and they're trying
respirators,
everything they do they can to try to save their lives. And what this is doing to the people that work in the intensive care unit is that it's giving them burnout, and they're feeling like it's going against their principles, because some of these people, in fact, I know somebody that told me this story that happened to his 89-year-old dad.
Yeah.
And he'd even done the living will and the health measures and all that, saying what he wanted when he died. And yet they were still doing all these different tests. And a lot of times they get dozens of specialists involved and end up doing extra tests and everything. Well, you know, for one thing, the hospital makes money on it.
You bet.
On all the tests besides the admissions and so forth. But is this about death denial?
Well, it's a fight against death. You know, doctors sometimes have the misconception that they're there to save everybody's life, and they're not. That is not what the role of a doctor is. A doctor is to work with patients and to do it their way, the best that you can, and not impose things on them. It's not like social services can impose things on you. You should have the permission of the patient or the family for the treatments that you do. And if they're really aggressive, you have the right to say no. And I think that our fear of death as physicians comes into play here. Well, if you can accept that life is a cycle and there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to it,
right,
and really go with that, then you try to make the passing on to the next phase of what's about to happen something that is respected and cherished and treated so that it's a celebration in some way.
It's not supposed to be a suffering.
No.
You know, and 75% of the elderly, when they've been questioned, prefer to die at home.
Yeah.
But 75% of them die in the hospital or in a nursing home.
Yeah, well.
And, you know, when you think about it, if they're home, it's actually a safer place anyway, because they don't have all the,
infections
and everything.
That's right. Well, there may be fear of legal action, too. I mean, what if they don't give the care that is thought to be right for this? I think you have to individualize every patient, because everybody is different. Every single person with hypertension is different. Every person with cancer is different. Every person who has ADD, they're all different. And you have to give individualized care that matches who that person is. So when you're at end-of-life issues, I think there are a lot of factors that need to be considered. And there are a lot of different kinds of people that I would want present if you were dying or I was dying.
Except for the fact, sometimes if there are too many people involved with the decision, that can cause conflicts.
Well, it can, too. And you can certainly think of examples of that. But what I'm thinking of is, if I'm dying, I want you there. I want you making decisions. I'd also like to have my doctor there. I think the doctor should have a lot to say about what happens. I think somebody who represents the administration that is concerned about costs should be there and participating and providing information. And I would like to have some spiritual counseling as well. So I think a whole team of people that look at various aspects of what I need should be there making decisions about what kind of treatment is being given.
Well, you know, too, as far as costs go, 85% is of the costs are paid for by government or insurance.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times the people don't even care or pay attention to what it costs.
No, if your insurance pays for it, who cares is what they say. But I care. I think if we're spending 50% of our health care dollars, okay, half of $2.8 trillion on the last month of care, something's wrong.
And this is what's going to eventually lead us to bankruptcy, to the United States,
well,
to bankruptcy.
It's one of the factors that's a big player. No question of that. When you're talking about 18% of the gross national product is being spent on health care, that's an enormous amount of money. We should be able to cut that back substantially because no other country in the world even spends a little bit more than half of that. So we're spending way too much. Maybe we should cut back on the amount we spend on health care and in defense and a lot of things that were really putting us into a lot of jeopardy financially.
Well, and 30% of hospitalizations aren't even necessary in the U.S. anyway.
Well, maybe.
But the way that some of these doctors and nurses were talking about this topic was one of the things that they said was that there are other patients that might be more deserving of that space in the intensive care unit. And they're mostly talking about these people that are so sick that they are going to die, mm-hmm. and yet they're doing everything to try to keep them alive. And it's like their body's alive because of all these tubes and everything that's in them.
Well, I think
this
that's
person
right.
that I was talking to said his wife was a nurse. And she knew the system, so she went with him and mm-hmm. talked to the nurses and the doctors
sure.
and said, can we just keep him comfortable, take out all these tubes, just give him morphine and let him be comfortable and go in peace.
Sure.
You know.
Well, it's one of the reasons why we have something called hospice, which I think does a good job.
Right, and people can die at home, too.
Well, yes, and as comfortably as possible. I mean, the idea isn't to do some enormous workup that's invasive and biopsies and machines where when somebody's got a fatal disease, whether it be heart failure or cancer or diabetes or whatever it is that's causing the problem, there's a time to say when. You have to use your judgment. And that's why I say every single person that I see is different. And I treat them as different and try to listen to their story and care about them and then try to support them through the process. And the decisions that we make, you know, they vary depending on who you are and what you want and what your situation's like and what your family thinks and what your economics are and what your insurance is like and what kind of impact that's going to have on the future of your family situation. You don't want to use all your money up, you know, at the end of life in the last week or two because you're trying to do heroic things that are really basically stupid to do because you're going to die anyway. It's not like death is the enemy. Death is not the enemy.
And it can be a beautiful experience, and yet all these people are dying miserable in the hospital
yes.
with all the tubes stuck
and often
in.
Alone, all by themselves with no one there to support them.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that we should be able to do a lot about. Just because somebody isn't there mentally because their biochemistry is all screwed up doesn't mean that they don't know some things and aren't aware of it. You could think of it as, what did your parents do for you when you grew up? You know, they took care of you.
And, you know, many people worry about feeling guilty, but, you know, about making the decision to pull the tubes or to let them go. But think about it. Maybe, you know, if you believe in God, I mean, this is what's happening.
Well,
God's saying, you know, this person's ready to go. We're the ones that are doing all these heroic things.
Yeah, well, it doesn't really work. You're right. We're not going to overrule what God intends. It's just not going to happen. but we can do our part responsibly.
And I mean, so I'm understand if it's somebody that's a child or somebody that's had an accident and there's hope for curing them or helping them. But, you know, then there are other issues that come up of like somebody's going to be brain dead and so on and so forth.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. And that's why I think it should be individualized. And this fear of legal repercussions, the fear of death, a fear of suffering is the other side of it, and doing what's appropriate. There are so many things that we can do that support people that aren't necessarily life-saving. You know, you can cure the symptoms sometimes, but if you're talking about true healing, now you're talking about looking at that person in a lot of different ways.
The body, mind, emotion, and spirit.
Yeah, you got to look at all those perspectives, and if you're just stuck in the physical plane and the biochemistry, I mean, what are we really talking about? We're not talking about something that's going to be in the best interest of our patient. All right, so it looks like we're just about out of time here. So I'd like to remind you that we'll be back live to talk about what's new in the news in health and take your health questions every Monday afternoon on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 3 to 4 Eastern Time and 12 to 1 Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health is also archived on DrSaputo.com as well as PRN.FM.
And if you've enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to drsaputo.com and check out our fast track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a wonderful week. We'll see you next week.